This week in the Magic Kitchen, we're joined by Yvonne Abreu, author of newest book, Changing Paths.
I'm Leandra Witchwood.
And I'm Elise Wells.
And welcome to the Magic Kitchen podcast, where we talk about magic, kitchen witchcraft, herbs,
and everything in between.
Magic Kitchen Podcast is funded and supported by thewitchwoodteahouse.com, offering a variety of hand-blended loose leaf teas as well as loose herbs for all of your ritual, spell work, wellness, and everyday enjoyment needs. If you would like to support this podcast while sipping a great cup of tea, head over to thewitchwoodteahouse.com and find the magic that's in store for you.
So we're recording this the day after the full moon, and we both had some incredible rituals that we'd love to share with you all.
Yes, I'm excited to share rituals with our listeners. So I'll start because mine's crazy and it spans 20 years, if you believe that or not. So this is a great example of even being a seasoned witch, like you still are human and you still mess up. So I've been working for the past couple of weeks, not more than that, a few weeks, with a deity that has been trying to reach out to me for about 20 years. Yeah, I'm saying that right, 20 years. And to give you some backstory, like I've always had a couple of pantheon or a couple of deities that I work with on a regular basis. So in my head, I don't need another deity, right? Like I'm cool. But the past couple of years, I felt the ones that I work with pulling back a little bit. And a little bit of context on that, I had gotten two different readings from two different very experienced, very well-renowned psychics who told me that there was an energy attached to me that was separating me from my deities and my spirit guides and that sort of thing. So I really kind of chalked it up to that the past couple of years. So I decided the past few weeks to like drop it and try and connect with this deity that obviously was trying to get a hold of me. And it takes me back to 20 years ago when she first reached out to me. And, you know, I saw her in this glade. It was, you know, big bonfire with standing stones and surrounded by trees. And she approached me as a very pale woman, but she had blonde hair. And then she turned into an owl as she was trying to connect with me. And at that moment, and here is why I've had such a hard time connecting. So this is a testament to why it's so important to not be disturbed when you're going into deep, deep trance and out of body experiences. The moment she started to transform into the owl, my husband entered the room, who was not supposed to be home, by the way, and he touched my foot, which literally slammed me back into my body and traumatized me. Like that was spiritual trauma.
Oh, yeah. That's scary.
It's not scary. It's not safe to be slammed back like that. So I literally had a big block up against her and me. So, you know, I tried to go on to it and I could never get back into that state again because of that spiritual trauma. So I've been slowly working and chipping away at it. And the past few weeks, I've been able to get back into it. And at the time, I had no idea who she was. I was so distraught. I didn't even try to do any research or anything like that to try and figure out who she was and who was trying to connect with me. I just kind of shut down. And so the past few weeks, I've been working to like lift that and work through that. And so I go back into meditation with this deity and I said, okay, I'm open. I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. And she approaches me again. We're in the same glade, same fire, same standing stones. But this time she has very pale skin and dark hair. And she approaches me and comes behind me and places two owl wings on my back. And the strangest thing was, I shouldn't say strange. It's not strange. It's confirmation. Ever since then, And during, like in between my shoulder blades, I feel tingling. Even now, as I'm talking about this, I've got chills and I've got this tingling sensation. Like there's a weight on my back, like there's something on my back. And as soon as she put the owl wings on me, they surrounded me. And like, I was in this like silent cocoon. Like it was so silent. It was so comfortable and warm and safe.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And I was like, whoa, it was so beautiful. It was so cool. So of course I go back to research, who is this deity and who's trying to reach out to me? What connection am I making here? And I didn't realize this, but I'm going back through all of my books. I'm going back through my art. Even behind me here, I was showing Elise that I have an image of her behind me that I bought 3 years ago and had no idea that this deity was trying to connect to me. So the deity is Arianrhod. And I know some people say that Welsh can't have a pantheon, but there's circumstances that allow that. But in the Welsh tradition, she is the goddess of the stars. Her place in the sky is the Corona Borealis. And she is known for ferrying the dead, for taking care of the dead and helping them pass on or reincarnate. Her symbols are the owl and the wolf. She's also associated with the moon, motherhood, and virginity, but not in the virginity. Think more sovereign. She's a very sovereign deity. Like her position is sovereignty, but her position also is blockages. She can either put blockages up or take them down. And so in trying to figure out who she was, like I go back through all my books and everything, books that I hadn't touched in like a year or two that are research books. Where were the points that I had stopped in those books? Was at Arianrhod.
Wow.
I had started researching her. I had started it, but I stopped for whatever reason. My, you know, human brain here. I had stopped. I had even bought, you know, jewelry and images and pictures that are her. But for some reason, I wasn't stepping over that threshold.
Yeah.
Well, but last night, during the full moon, I'm like, okay, I'm doing this ritual to honor her. I'm going to connect with her. If you followed me on TikTok or Instagram, you would have seen part of it. I put part of it up there to help others also connect with her if you wish. But what I did was, okay, the fire is dying out. It's like midnight or so. It's really getting late. And the fire is almost gone. I had no more wood to put on the fire. So I'm sitting there and the moon is like huge, right above me, huge, massive, and so, so bright. And I was trying to do a dark mirror scrying. It wasn't connecting. I wasn't connecting with it. I was trying to do fire scrying. I wasn't connected with it. I was really having trouble with it until I finally just relaxed and I sat back in my chair and looked up at the moon. And the craziest thing, like you're going to think I'm nuts because I still think I'm nuts, but it was the most amazing experience. All of a sudden the moon began to vibrate. It began to like shimmer and vibrate and gyrate in the sky. And then the more I connected with it, the more I just sat there and relaxed into it. All of a sudden this like silver wheel began spinning around the moon, just spinning, 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 faster, faster, faster. And another association with Arianrhod, she is the silver wheel because she's connected to the Celtic lunar calendar, the Celtic wheel of the year. So it was just amazing, like fireworks in the sky. Amazing, amazing.
Oh, that's so, so cool. Yeah, this was a powerful full moon. And it's not a coincidence as well that it's lunar Lammas. Nope. The same day.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. we also, at this period of August 2023, we're also in a few retrogrades, but the kind that actually aren't so bad, like Pluto's retrograde. So that's affecting our intuition and making us feel a little bit more aware of what we're intuiting, which can be good. It keeps us from being impulsive. Also on that note, Venus is in retrograde. So it's a good chance to really take a step back and look at your relationships. So and Saturn is also in retrograde. So that's having us look at, you know, our relationship to wealth and power. And instead of looking outward for those things, looking inward for our power. Mm-hmm. So this full moon, the energy was overwhelming for a lot of us. I also, I didn't sleep well last night and I woke up really early and just, you know, gave up. Like it was not a, I'm getting back to sleep kind of day or night, you know, but that's okay. Sometimes you just have to channel that energy. So, and I haven't talked about it on the podcast because it arose completely out of necessity. Greece has been having devastating wildfires. As we do every summer, they're getting increasingly terrible and dangerous every year. And this year, after the ninth day of these fires on Rhodos, on Rhodes, the island of Rhodes, that caused mass evacuations for all tourists. And it's and that's not it. I mean, also Corfu, we call it Kerkyra, that they had to evacuate parts of Corfu because of fires. And the island right across from my house, so when I'm hanging my laundry, I'm looking at it, is Evia. And also when I swim, the ash is in our sea, and it's very hard to get away. And we also had fires just a mile from my house this year. So there was a lot of a lot of powerlessness being felt in Greece this summer. So I put together a full moon ritual to prevail upon the fire spirits. And I also invoked my patron god, Hephaestus, to as the king of fire and the forge, to appeal to these spirits and help to quell these flames and protect the creatures that are unwittingly being victimized by these fires.
Right.
Because it, unfortunately, in the news, so much of the rhetoric is, oh, tourists lost their vacations, when these are places that have been inhabited for thousands upon thousands of years that are now being deemed unfit to live in because of the fire risk. Right. Not war, not anything, you know, that these people could have said, oh, well, you know, I'm going to do what I can. I mean, these are effects of climate change, not necessarily incurred by these rural villagers. I mean, for the most part, especially on Evia, they really do not have a hand in, you know, these, they are not the Coca-Cola corporation. They are not Nestle. Right. Like, it's just not fair. Yeah. It's just not fair. These in Evia, I could go on and on about these rural populations. They're preserving these traditions that are not seen anywhere else in Greece or the world. So these fires are devastating to culture. They're devastating to paganism and our history as witches. It's devastating to the individuals who live here. So I was really moved when I had just 5 days to put together this ritual. First things first, I was struggling with it. I messaged Leandra. I messaged my high priestess. I messaged a friend of mine who's also a high priestess. I was like, what do we do? What should I do? And they were like, most people were like, oh, do a rain spell. But instantly, when I put that to the land spirits, they're like, no, because rain is not natural right now. So this was a good lesson in ritual creation. What we think is our first instinct of, oh, I would do this, that's not what nature would do. So again, like, it was such a lesson for me as a witch. And then, so I put it to Hephaestus. I said, okay, what do we do here? And he's like, I think we just need to talk to these fire spirits. Because I also knew banishing wasn't the right approach. It's not there was no execration that needed to happen here. It's about prevailing upon these fire spirits. It's about talking them down. It's about explaining to them that what they're doing, even though it's natural, is not what is best for their land right now. So we had 5 days to get the word out. And actually we had 11 people attending live across four different zones, which was amazing. Good. And we also had a solid handful, 37 different people, three of which weren't people, they were actually covens, do the ritual on their own outside of the space that I held online. So that was really, really, really powerful. And actually, if you're just hearing this within August 2023, there's an abridged version of the spell that only takes 1 minute. It's just an incantation. You light a candle, and then using sympathetic magic, you douse that candle in some water. You can get that. So if you message me on Instagram or email me at elise@seekingnumina.com, I will be happy to send you that so you can send some energy to ending these fires. And already today, there's been no reports of new fires. So the energy is really working, which is powerful. Very, very powerful to feel. You may have noticed that here at the Magic Kitchen Podcast, we don't have sponsored ads. That's because this is a fully listener-supported show. We do what we do for you, dear listener. And when you join my magical living community on Patreon, you're supporting all the time and energy that goes into setting up podcast interviews, writing articles and rituals, my paranormal mystery novel, and all that I do. And in exchange, you're getting over 10 exclusive journal prompts, rituals, witch tip videos, meditations, and more each month. If you love this podcast, consider joining my magical space. I can't wait to meet you and be an even bigger part of your magical journey. Go to patreon.com/Elise Wells or follow the link in the show notes. So before we get into our interview with Yvonne Abreu, author of lots of books, but recently Changing Paths, which we're going to talk about today, we have a little bit of bad news.
No, I know. I'm not going to be here for this interview. I have a prior engagement that I must attend to. So I'm really bummed that I'm going to miss this interview.
Yeah, dates got switched around for some things, and it's a shame. But we didn't want to deprive you, our dear listeners, of the experience of meeting Yvonne. So without further ado, enjoy our interview.
Yvonne Abreu has been a pagan since 1985 and a Wiccan since 1991. They have an MA in Contemporary Religions and Spiritualities from Bath Spa University and moved to Cambridge, Ontario, Canada in May 2018. They have written 4 books on mythology and folklore. Their most recent books are Changing Paths, 2023, Dark Mirror, The Inner Work of Witchcraft, 2020, which I love. It is on my bedside table every day of my life. The Night Journey, Witchcraft as Transformation, also in 2020, and All Acts of Love and Pleasure, Inclusive Wicca, 2014. They blog at Dowsing for Divinity. So I'm personally really thrilled to have you on the Magic Kitchen podcast because our listeners, we haven't had a guest like you before in the best way. Your books are always so, well, literally in one case, inclusive, and they provide a different perspective on witchcraft than any other author. And Yvonne has also been gracious enough to be our guest in the Baltimore Pagans Book Club that I co-moderate. So that also means a lot to me. In fact, we're reading Inclusive Wicca next month as of this recording, which is going to be great. They're going to join us for that too. So thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. And I loved being on the book club chat. It was really great. Like, who doesn't love people saying nice things about their books? Like, perfect.
Yeah, I guess. I feel that way too. Like, when my novel comes out next year, I'm actually really hopeful that book clubs will invite me. Yeah. Because I love being on the receiving end of having authors come, and I'd love to try the other side.
Yeah, that'd be great. I will read it with interest. So very cool. Oh,
thank you. I would like to start. I mentioned it a little bit, but Dark Mirror is the first book of yours that I've read. I'm still working inclusive Wicca right now, and I'm inclusive Wicca, but really it's about inclusive practicing in general. And I think that's an important message for anybody, especially newer to their craft, to feel that empowered step forward.
Yeah. So I wrote All Acts of Love and Pleasure Includes Wicca because I'd had a wobble about which more later. And part of the reason for my wobble was because paganism can be so heterocentric. and then I had a coming back to paganism thing. And I was like, right, okay, well, I'm going to do something about the issue that was part of the cause of the wobble. So the first thing I did was to write All Acts of Love and Pleasure Inclusive Wicca and say, like, hey, you know, paganism and Wicca don't have to be heterocentric. You know, it's not like people are actively, there are active homophobes in paganism, but thankfully they're a minority. But even heterocentric behavior can be sort of bordering on the homophobic. Like, a friend of mine took his new partner to a pagan federation conference, and they joined a circle dance, and they were holding hands, obviously, because they were partners. And this woman jumps in between them and goes, oh no, I can't have two men holding hands.
Oh my gosh.
Because dancing, circle dancing has to be boy, girl, right? So it's not necessarily that she was being actively homophobic, but that, you know, if you didn't know the context, that that circle dancing is supposed to be boy-girl. A lot of traditions have this thing that you have to have circle dancing boy-girl, boy-girl. It just comes across as massively homophobic.
Yeah. And yeah, I've heard that too. Like, yeah. And that's the problem, like heteronormative, like the normal, the baseline is heterosexual. And I think that's pervasive, less so today. I do think things are definitely getting better, but I do agree. Like, you know, we try to be respectful of, you know, the earlier books in the craft, but there is sometimes, you know, you're enjoying it. And then all of a sudden you come up against something and you're like, oh, geez. Like, you know, there's just like the language and it's so sexual and, Yeah.
I mean, like, I think that the erotic has its place, but there's a difference between sublimated eros, a sense that we're all celebrating the joy of sexuality in all its glorious variety, and overt sexual behavior, which is not what you want in a group of, in a mixed group of people who, you know, haven't necessarily signed up for that kind of thing. And it's interesting because, like, I've noticed that there are people who don't, when I say sublimated eros, they've got no idea what I'm talking about.
Give us your definition for that term.
Yeah, so I can't think of, so for me, it's like, okay, we're celebrating that sexuality and sexual pleasure is a part of the divine in paganism, and we, you know, like, if you have a feeling of the sort of vaguely sexy, not actually sexy feelings, but like if you have vaguely sexy feelings in a circle, they are transformed, i.e. sublimated in an in the alchemical sense of the word sublimated. They are transformed and consumed and become part of the overall atmosphere, heightened atmosphere of joy. So it's not like we're not acting on the sexual feelings, we're transforming them into, they're part of the fuel, if you like, for the magic. That's what sublimated means. And I think a lot of people, you know, like if you've had that experience in circle, then you know what I'm talking about. And if you haven't had that experience in circle, you're like, what are they talking about? So now I explain it to people because, you know, it's kind of, that's a difficult one.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting because I was in a circle as a guest. So this wasn't with my own coven. Now, my own coven, they're based in Pennsylvania. So unfortunately, now that I live in Greece, it is a distance relationship, you know, so that's a very different type of circling anyway on Zoom. But even still, they're, everybody in our coven, except for myself, are crones. So that energy is so different. But then I was a guest in a circle that the average age was probably 30. And that was exactly the feeling. Nobody was hitting on each other. Nobody was looking at each other in that, you know, leering way. But I could tap into, there was like another energy people were giving off. And I was like, if I wasn't here, would this be a different type of circle? Like, I wasn't sure what it was, but like I said, I didn't get like the vibes of, like, it wasn't overtly sexual. Like you said, mm-hmm. It was just present and it did contribute, you know, like, you know, by libation, everything had this almost like you could cut it with a knife energy to it. Very different from the settled earthy crone energy that my coven has.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that is exactly what I mean by sublimation, in that it has, you know, it, we've taken that energy and we've done something with it. It's not that we've acted on it. We've transformed it into our magic. Like, if there's, and obviously, you know, one of my other books that I co-edited a book with Christine Hoff Kramer called Pagan Consent Culture, talks about, like, it's a collection of essays from different people talking about consent in paganism and grounding consent culture in pagan mythology and ideas. And
that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's like some of the stuff in there is gold. It's really good. So you know, I think that's a really important message, that that consent is everything. So, you know, try to reinforce that in Dark Mirror and The Night Journey, because I think a lot of books don't touch on consent in the way that they should. You know,
they dance around it.
Yeah, like newer books, yes. I think most of the newer books are with the program, right? You know, we've seen all the scandals and stuff that went down in around 2010, the sort of second decade of this century. And people are much more aware of consent now. The thing that's quite interesting is when you look at the Wiccan initiation ceremony, there are three moments when you are asked, are you sure? Mm. You know, they're couched in fancy language, but there are three points in the ritual where you are asked, are you sure this is what you want? You know, you can turn back now if you want. We can stop now if you want. It's like there is consent moment there. Because that's always difficult, because it's like, okay, you're consenting. When you consent to be initiated in advance, you're like, well, I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of people are intimidated by group work because of those unknowns. And we've done some episodes in the past where we talk about magical consent. And then we also have done some where we talk about finding a group and how to do that in a healthy way. It is important. Like knowing up front exactly what happens in an initiation, of course you can't, but we can know the limits to which it'll be pushed. We can know,
yes,
you know, what you'll be wearing. You know, some covens, I had a seeker contact me like a good couple years ago, and they found a different group, and it was very good, because I'm not a high priestess, but they just were like, I'm getting these strange questions. And they were basically not allowed to ask if they would practice Skyclad or not. You know, like some of these, it's like this kind of transparency is necessary. And if you're not getting that, that's not a practicing witchcraft group.
That's a red flag.
You know, Ponzi scheme. Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, on the Gardnerian Wicca website, which if you look it up, it's Gardnerian Wicca, an unofficial but informative website. Because you can't have an official website. Yes, but we need it. Come on. A group of us made a website, and on there I've got a list of red flags, and that similar list of red flags is included in, I think I included it in All Acts of Love and Pleasure Inclusive Wicca. It's also in Dark Mirror or The Night Journey.
Yes. It's in Dark Mirror, yeah.
Yeah, and it's on my blog as well. Like there are multiple places where I have put up the list of red flags. Like if a group does multiple ones of these things on this list, then that's worrying. You run away. Because I think people just kind of get to a group and they go, oh yeah, like this will be fine. You know, like the gods led me to this group, so they must be good, and you know, there's that kind of new relationship energy thing going on. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, they're lovely people, it must be all right. And people sail through the red flags, you know, pushing it down the back of the sofa, like, oh, I'll just ignore that red flag that just went by. And we've all done it. But, you know, that's why you need a list of red flags up front and people saying to you, I mean, I personally think that practicing Skyclad before people are initiated, it's not a red flag exactly, but it's not a good idea. I would want to get to know people before, and they want to get to know me. Like people need to know that we are trustworthy people who aren't going to do unpleasant things to them, you know? You can't just go, right, okay, we're doing outer court Skyclad from the get-go. That's crazy.
I would think so too. If you're already in a nudist type environment as a person generally, maybe it wouldn't be so uncomfortable, it feels ulterior.
The group I joined, you know, many years ago, they didn't have Skyclad. I mean, they didn't have out of court, to be fair. but I had a getting to know you. Like Wicca has always had a thing where you can't be initiated until you've known your initiators for a year and a day. Some people make it longer than that. because you need to know, you need to have spent time with the people to make sure you can trust them and that you feel comfortable with them. And, you know, it's, and you have to know that that person's going to play well in the dynamic of your group, because being in a coven is a very high trust environment. Because we're getting into some pretty intense spiritual stuff, and also, well, people are naked, right? So, but yeah, I definitely think, like, no, we're not even gonna, you're not even allowed to ask if we practice Skyclad. Like, that is a red flag, right? I mean, of course people want to know that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think too, like, even if everything's fine in a coven, and your book Changing Paths discusses this kind of, what's the word for it? Realizations, maybe, like, you know, how do you know a path is for you, and how do you move on from a path? Like, sometimes a path has served us, you know, that's a tough moment to realize that you've outgrown a situation that you're in.
Mm. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that I found, I mean, there are people who practice more than one path at the same time.
Yeah.
Good for them if they've got that amount of time in the day, in the, you know, in their week. But personally, I found it's like, if I'm on a path, I need to give everything to that path. And I can't, you know, so like trying to practice two paths in parallel just didn't work for me. I know lots of people it does work for, and who have managed to somehow syncretize those two paths, and good for them, because that takes a lot of commitment and a lot of processing. So, like, no shade on those people at all. But for me, I just found, like, I'm a one path kind of person. And the reason that I had a wobble was because I had unresolved stuff from my Christian upbringing that I needed to deal with. And I hadn't actually dealt with it adequately at all. And so I had to go through a process of dealing with it so that I could move on with my paganism. And I am so thankful that the Unitarian movement, and it in the UK it's called the Unitarian movement, in the US it's called Unitarian Universalism, for various historical reasons, but I am so thankful that they were there to catch me and hold me and, you know, look after me while I was, you know, recovering from my wobble. At the end of the day, it's like, it wasn't my long-term path. And I realized, you know, I need to focus on one path. You know, I remain very thankful that they exist, because they were super helpful.
Yeah. And I've actually directed people to their local UU, because not only is the UU there, but they also host other things like cups.
Yeah.
Like in Baltimore, we have the Frederick Cups group, and they're so great. Like, I went to a few of their public, I went to Ostara 1 year, and I went to Imbolc 1 year, separate years, but they're just such wonderful people, and they're so welcoming. And I also have noticed, at least at that UU, that the ages really vary, which I think is really beneficial. Like, Leandra and I, we're a generation apart. So every listener to the Magic Kitchen podcast gets these two perspectives every episode. And I think, like, in a coven or in a public ritual or at a pagan con event, like, it's so helpful to have that variety's energy.
Yeah. I mean, I remember thinking, like, once I started to get to know people among the Unitarians, it's like, oh, so this is where all the old radicals went. Because they'd all been at the CND campaign for nuclear disarmament protests in the 60s and 70s. Oh, wow. And, you know, like, they'd been on all the feminist marches, and they were really cool. So I was like, that's where they all went. That's so cool. Like, lovely people. And you know, the other day, like, I got invited to contribute some poetry to a Unitarian anthology, so, you know.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really nice. So we're still, you know, we're still besties.
Yeah. Well, and I get that vibe too. Like that is a path that would probably be pretty okay with any concurrency you might be interested in bringing to the table, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the weird thing is, I will say, and I don't know about you in the States, but, or indeed Unitarians in Canada, but one thing I will say is that it was super difficult. If you wanted to be a Christo-pagan, oddly enough, Unitarianism would not work as a Christo-pagan place to hang out, or it wouldn't have done a decade ago when I was involved. For the simple reason that there's a Christian faction, and there's a pagan faction, and then there's the Unitarians in general, and like it would be really difficult to have a foot on both of those islands. Things may have changed because things do move on. The idea of Christo-paganism, you know, again, no shade on people who practice it, but blows my mind.
Well, I've always had a hard time. Leandra and I talk about it a lot on the podcast, actually, like wrapping our heads around it, because of course, like the biggest oppressor of our path as pagans and witches has been Christians.
Yep.
But I'm in it's a course that's one lecture every month for 7 months with Marguerite Johnson. And she's a professor emeritus with Newcastle University of Australia. And she is explaining things in ways I never considered. The course is on magic in ancient Greece and Rome. So each lecture is sort of, you know, like the most recent one was spell books. Next is amulets. We had one on Hecate as a figure. We had one on, what was it? It was the most fascinating one. I think it was like ritual as a concept, like, oh, curse tablets. That's what it was on. Curse tablets.
Yeah, those are
fascinating. She's had the pleasure of really getting to see these in person. So some of her photos were really good. But if anyone ever has the chance, Marguerite Johnson does. If she's doing anything anywhere online, go. But it was really cool because I didn't realize we see the dates on these things. You know, they're found at 200 AD, 300 AD. But in my mind, it was pagans still practicing paganism. But what she explained is that a lot of Christians used magic too, and openly. Like it really overlapped much longer than the Catholic Church version of history wants us to know.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that there's one of the sort of surviving pieces of evidence from that time is the papyri Greekae Magicae, which, they're very, very syncretic of ancient paganism and Judaism and Christianity and all the different magics that involves. My husband and I did a video on the history of magical tools, and we found a lot of magic use in Judaism and Christianity and Islam as well, some of which is, I happen to know, is still in use in those communities. And I think that what happened, unfortunately, is that I forget when the Diocletian persecution was, but up until the Diocletian persecution, the Christians were incredibly diverse, and there were all these different churches, and they couldn't agree on anything. So then the Emperor Diocletian comes along and massacres a huge number of Christians, and the survivors didn't have enough people to populate all these individual little churches, so they had to come together and find the common ground that they agreed on. So then Constantine becomes emperor and says, all right, I'm going to legalize Christianity. So like, let's have, so then they have the council. This is oversimplified version, but more or less, right? So then they have the Council of Nicaea, and Constantine shows up and he goes, right, okay, what's going on then? Then they've had 3 days already of chatting away. So somebody presents him with this huge stack of paper, like, you know, 3 feet high or something. And says, well, this is the record of all our deliberations so far. And Constantine goes, I'm not reading all that shit. Bungs it in the brazier, where it burns to a crisp, and says, come up with something simple that everybody can understand. And that is how the Nicene Creed came into being, where that every Christian had to sign up to. And if you didn't sign up to it, you're a heretic. So
the one holy Catholic and apostolic church, right?
Yeah. Isn't that the Athanasian Creed?
I don't know. See, I'm Greek Orthodox. Yes. So that's the one I know.
Maybe it isn't there. Anyway, you guys have a different version of the creed because it doesn't have the filioque clause in it, which was the source between the Catholics and the Orthodox.
Yeah, the schism. I'm trying to put it all in order in my head, but yeah, like here, of course, they revere Constantine and they still call Istanbul Constantinople and Greece, I mean. And yeah, it's interesting too, like, and I think this is a very like American problem. Like modern Christians practice a very different version of Christianity than was envisioned by any of these folks in the olden times. And I think that is why like evangelical Christianity it doesn't mix with paganism because it's the ultimate oppressor. Yeah, you know, I mean, sorry for anyone listening, but it is. By nature, evangelism is sinister, really.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I always draw a distinction between evangelizing and proselytizing and interfaith dialogue. So
interfaith dialogue. Colonization.
You know, I'm a insert religion of choice. This is what we do. You know, tell you about my stuff and my beliefs in a neutral way. And then the other person tells you about theirs and you shake hands and it's all fine. Evangelizing to me is, hey, I've got the best thing since sliced bread and, you know, like you should worship my God because you'd be happy. Proselytizing is different from, is the more extreme thing because proselytizing is,
okay,
if you don't worship my God, he will send you to hell.
Which is, I think, the narrative lately.
Yeah.
In the West.
That is the dark. It's like proselytizing is the dark twin of evangelizing. And it's kind of always been there. But I think, because evangelos means good news in Greek, obviously, or good message, people don't necessarily see the dark side. Whereas if you say proselytizing, I can't remember what the root of that word is, but that is the thing where you say, if you don't believe in my stuff, you're going to go to hell. And I think it's helpful to make that distinction.
Yes.
Especially if you get into any sort of interfaith dialogue with people, it helps to have that language because then you know where the red line is.
Thanks for sharing that distinction because, and that is important to have these interfaith dialogues. I think that's like a core part of why so many come to paganism is that it's so like conversational. It's an active path, first of all. Like we never say, oh, I want these things to happen. All right, God, do it. Good. Okay, I'm done. I'm not going to worry about it anymore. No. You know, like it's actually the opposite for us. Like we contact the gods for help. We're like, join us in our corner because I want to make this happen. And I'm going to do more work after we're done talking too. You know, like it's not just that 1 minute prayer that we send up.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And we also don't, like, we look for common ground and we look for ways to constantly challenge our own faiths. At least I do. And I think a lot of our listeners do based on the questions and the things that we end up talking about. Because, like, I'm actually fascinated when somebody's like, oh, but really, animism is, you know, I was just in a conversation about animism, so I stole my mind. But somebody was explaining how they come to animism from a Taoist perspective of seeking balance in our relationship with nature versus everything has a spirit. And, you know, like we were talking about like veganism versus non-veganism, like what's more ethical, you know, like you can tie anything to our practice and beliefs as witches and pagans, because we can always look for those different angles and we can both leave still feeling correct, but maybe we're going to think about it differently because we had a conversation.
I like that. I mean, I think that, you know, I had a friend who was Catholic, and for a while I joined a discussion group that he was in, and there were a lot of Catholics in there. And every so often there would be like a little, somebody would drop a little bomb into the conversation, which was, you can't say that, it's heretical. I've seen all kinds of shit go down in pagan online discussions. I've never seen anyone say, you can't say that, it's heretical.
Yeah, I agree.
Because it's such an ender of conversations, but I've never seen that happen in a pagan group. Like I've seen
that's why a lot of us got laughed out of our Sunday schools, you know, like
Like I really got removed. Like they called down the deacon to take me out because I was trying to understand. I was just trying to understand. I really was. I was like eight. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but how is sin all equal? I was like, why is forgiveness granted on deathbeds when somebody can be as evil as they want and know they'll be forgiven? That just doesn't make sense. Yeah. Like I couldn't. And they were like, you don't need to be asking these questions. That's, you know, they didn't use the word heretic that I recall, but that's pretty much where they're going with it. You know, yeah. I was removed from the class. And that's that, you know, I never was like, oh, maybe they're right. Like, I was like, okay, I'm not Christian. Sure. I didn't know I was pagan at that moment, but that's where it all began. You know, those kinds of days in Sunday school.
Great question. Yeah. I mean, I went to a very weird church that, or I was taken to a very weird church that didn't have Sunday because they thought that there's something in the Bible about not dividing the meeting or not dividing the community, and they thought that that applied to Sunday school, so kids had to sit in the main thing with the adults, you know, which is quite good really, because I wasn't listening to what the adults were talking about. The only thing I had to read was the Bible, so I was like, all right, let's see all these stories in the Old Testament. What do you mean this tribe took that tribe and cut all their foreskins off and then murdered them? Like, what?
Yeah.
And stole them.
Oh my God. Yeah.
You know, like, so I was very familiar with all the really dodgy bits from an early age.
Yeah. I did the same thing. I was like, really? I was determined. I was like, no, it's okay. Everybody I know is this religion. It must be the right one. That's what they're telling me. So I'm going to really dedicate myself. And I read Leviticus cover to cover, the whole book. Wow. And I was like, this is terrifying. You know, there's that bit in there where it's like, she couldn't conceive, so she got her dad drunk. You know, it's like,
oh yeah.
What are we doing? I was like, that was like before I had the talk, you know, I was like, this is horrifying. Yes. But that's a book that the kids can read in schools in Florida.
I know, right? It's crazy, crazy stuff. And like, the interesting thing is, if you look at the way Judaism manages all of this, it's very, very different.
Because, is it?
Yeah. Well, for one thing, like, you know, if you go and join, a friend of mine went and joined Judaism. So, and she was telling me about how she had previously been at a Christian church, and she would ask questions like your awkward question about sin, right? And the Christians would go, oh, I don't want to think about that. And then she went to the synagogue and they were like, oh, that's a really great question. Yeah, let's look at it. And, you know, let's look at it from all these different angles. And here's what Rabbi so-and-so said about it. And like, here's all the thoughts that have been discussed about, you know, and they love discussing that kind of stuff. And, you know, like when they look at biblical exegesis, you know, how to interpret the Bible, their thing is like every interpretation that we end up with, it will have been discussed endlessly because they like a lot of discussion, but once they end up at an interpretation, it has to tend towards love. It must be a loving interpretation. So like, and they decided that in the second century of the current era. So I just have so much respect for Judaism. I think it's an amazing religion. Like people, one of the things that really gets up my nose is people saying the phrase Judeo-Christian as if the Jews were to blame for the nonsense the Christians get up to. Like,
That's very true.
Don't use that phrase. Like, the Christians persecuted the Jews mercilessly. We shouldn't be using the phrase Judeo-Christian in the same way that, you know, we've got
scratching
our heads about the idea of Christo-paganism because Christians persecuted pagans. Well, we should also challenge the use of the phrase Judeo-Christian whenever we see it. And like learn about these different religions and their histories, because, you know, I think one of the things that really, really helped me in getting properly deconstructed from my Christian upbringing was reading a book, and there's a TV series that goes with it as well, but like watch the TV series to give you the overview and then read the book as well. It's The History of Christianity by Diarmaid McCulloch. So it's a great TV series because he's a really great presenter. And I mean, he's got an interesting story in that he couldn't become a vicar because he's gay. So he became a theologian instead. And I met him once. I was just like, oh, God, giant fangirl squee. But like, he's so nice. And he's such a nice guy as well. Anyway, he did this TV series and then he did the book. And the book explains the history of all these different sects that were arguing about this and that and the other thing. And it's just a really good read. And I would recommend, you know, I always like one of my videos on YouTube. I've got a series of videos to go with Changing Paths on YouTube.
Fantastic. We'll link those in the show notes too then.
Great. Yeah. And I've got a resources website as well, changingpathsresources.ca. Because Changing Paths was already taken. I think it's really, really helpful to understand the history of where we've come from and what we're moving away from, so that, like, you know, because Christianity, I like to liken it to, because I'm a computer nerd, right? So religions are like software. Christianity is like Microsoft. Once you've installed it on your operating system, bloody hard to get rid of, and everything seems to be written in Microsoft languages, right? So Satanism is Linux, because Linux is opposed to Microsoft, or Satanism opposed to Christianity. Paganism is like open source software, because we roll our own. And the Unitarians and the Quakers are basically Apple Mac. Everybody thinks Apple Mac is cool, but nobody actually owns one.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, but I just think, you know, like, as a piece of software, I guess that makes Judaism DOS, but anyway, that's super nerdy. there was more to the analogy, but it got super nerdy after that. So if you're like me and like these metaphors, then it's still the piece I wrote about it is still on my blog.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah,
I think there's a fear in a lot of witches that, like, if they dip their toes into researching religions outside of paganism, and I think this comes from a lot of Christian upbringings, that they're like cheating on witchcraft, or that, you know, that they're not being true to their path, or that they'll offend their deities.
Yeah, but it's not about, it's again, it's like, are we talking interfaith dialogue? Or are we talking about, or are we talking about evangelism? So, I mean, obviously we're not going to read evangelical Christian shit, because it'll be... But
it won't be helpful for your research because it's not going to be research.
Yeah, I
mean, it's going to be opinions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's also about, like, you know, you want something that is like an objective history of, you know, I just found it incredibly helpful. Like, I also really like the work of Karen Armstrong. She's an interesting person because she grew up Catholic, became a nun at the age of, I don't know, 17 or 18. It all went horribly wrong and she ended up quitting because she got anorexia and was really, really ill. And the reason she got anorexia was not because she had a body image problem, but it was because the food was so bloody terrible in these places. Yeah, so really interesting story. And she's written about, she's done her autobiography explaining all this, but the stuff that I found particularly useful was her biography of God.
That's a great
concept. Which talks about, like, okay, this is all the history of the concept of God throughout the centuries, how we went from polytheism to monotheism and what that means and how we approach that. So that's super interesting, super useful, as it just helps to deconstruct these things, you know, like, I remember when I first became a pagan, I read Joseph Campbell's Oriental Mythology. Now, I think Joseph Campbell's a bit problematic in that he was apparently quite right wing. But again, that book was super helpful because it made me realize just how many dying and resurrecting gods there are and in the Near East, because it's like there are hundreds of them, and the whole concept of a dying and resurrecting god just isn't unique.
Exactly. And that's the syncretic universality of myth, belief, practices. That to me is at the core of my academic witchcraft, if that makes sense. Like, it helps me, outside of the practical side of magic, really find more grounding in my beliefs, because I can find, you know, why is Christmas when it is? We all know about, like, you know, the pagan connections to Christmas, but it doesn't stop there. It's everything. Yeah. They couldn't rein us in. So they said, okay, well, I guess, you know, when you guys in Athens are celebrating Dionysius coming back to life, I guess that's when we're going to celebrate Jesus now, because you're already having a parade.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, that's what happened here.
Yeah.
So it's so fascinating. And I think people get very worried about doing religions wrong. Like, you know, I need to be a good witch. Like, we're just not that kind of path. Like, the more you learn about other ones, it's probably either going to affirm your path you're on here, or you have some other work you need to do in deconstructing the path you were on, or switching the path that you thought you were going to be on because it's not serving you, or no longer serving you.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, shout out to all the folk witches who use Christian symbolism in their magic, right? There's a lot of that about. And so they're going to be butting up against Christian ideas a lot more. So they need to do this process as well. Like,
And hoodoo and voodoo. And there's so many practices that it's so entrenched, but it shouldn't be unwrapped. It should just be it should be discovered what it's doing. You know, I think we can't take anything at face value with any magical practice, but some of them, you know, we see these hymns to, like, they're like, okay, call on St. Anthony for this, and then add the blood of something for that. But it's in the same book, and you're like, well, how can that be?
Yeah. Right. I mean,
answer that question.
Whatever lights,
you know, if you're doing your research.
But yeah, everybody has to answer these questions for themselves. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've tried to do with Changing Paths is to give people the tools to go, okay, does my current path, whatever that is, and I've, like, deliberately made the first half of the book not, although it's obviously based in my experience with deconstructing from Christianity, I deliberately didn't make it specifically about Christianity. It's made it applicable to any path. Mm. So, like, hopefully somebody who is leaving, you know, some other tradition can gain from that as well. And then the second half of the book is about coming into paganism, because again, that's my experience, but again, it could apply to joining any group, because you know, it's all about, okay, so you're joining this new group, does it meet your needs, does it are there red flags, are you joining the outermost, you know, because most traditions, I think, have a sort of entry area in the same way that we have outer court in covens. And, you know, there's like pagan pub moots and eclectic pagan groups, which are low commitment. You need that space of, like, low commitment paganism, other group, where you can explore. So, like, for instance, you know, anybody can show up to a Quaker meeting. But if you're serious about becoming a Quaker, they have a course that helps to induct you into the ways of Quakerism. If you show up to the Unitarians, you know, anybody can go to a Unitarian church. But if you want to become serious about Unitarianism, you join a covenant group, or whatever the thing is. And you know, somebody goes, hey, do you want to be on a committee? But to which the answer is no, always no. But, like, I think that, you know, each group has a low level commitment, a low commitment phase or area.
Yeah.
Just go and check it out. And then there's the more commitment-based thing. Like, I mean, obviously Christianity, if somebody was joining Christianity as an adult, they'd be a, you know, they'd hang around, go to the church and do whatever. And only later would they get baptized or whatever, because that's the big commitment thing. And what Christianity has done that's sneaky, obviously, is by becoming the dominant religion of our culture, they just try and get everybody when they're little, when they're kids. And it shouldn't be like that. It should be, right, okay, I'm old enough to have spiritual thoughts. You know, like, obviously children have spirituality, but it should be, the children should be allowed to explore their spirituality in a safe, in a safe way, not be, you know, like, I mean, I remember as a kid, like, thinking, oh, I don't want to go to heaven because I'll have to leave my teddy bears behind.
I know. I remember thinking, like, all that singing. Oh, no, thank you.
No, I know, right?
So my dad used to tell me, it's just angels singing. I was like, I don't know. That doesn't sound like it's for me.
Yeah, like, there's some Methodist hymn about how we will be singing for 10,000 years around the throne of God. And I'm like, I think, you know, I like singing, but that's going to get a bit dull after a while.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's weird. But yeah, like, I think I'm always in favor. Like, I am very keen on history and archaeology as well.
Yeah, me too.
So I'm always in favor of knowing the history of an idea. Because, you know, it's like, yes, it's true to some extent that Christianity put its festivals on top of our festivals, but it's a lot more complicated than that. Like Easter, we didn't have a festival at Easter. So, like, you know, read Adrian Bott on that subject, super fascinating. He's written like a whole series of posts about how, like, what actually happened with Easter and paganism and Christianity. Super interesting. You know, the real history is always more interesting than the sort of 5-second soundbite version, you know?
Yeah, that's so true. Have you had signs, experiences, or dreams lately that made you stop and wonder, was that the call from deity? Maybe you know you've had the call, but you're not sure you want to answer. This is the sign you've been waiting for to take the next step with deity work in your spiritual practice. My next workshop, join me August 26th at 4 p.m. EST for a 90-minute course providing you with tools, steps forward, different perspectives, and various explorations on the aspects of deity work so that you can know which path to take on your journey with the god or goddess. This workshop will be recorded for anyone who can't attend live. Early bird tickets are on sale until August 10th. Whether you've never worked with deity before or you're ready to take your deity work to the next step, this workshop is for you. I look forward to seeing you there.
So, in your, I guess, opinion, and in your research, how important are labels for a spiritual practice? Because so many people are very, very set on practicing solo, or even with their group, they have their personal practice outside of that. And labels can sometimes get overwhelming. Like, people get really hung up. And if I'm a green witch, does that mean I can't work with, you know, the sea? If I'm a sea witch, does that mean I can't go to forests? Like, people get really, really like, oh, I need to find the label. How does that play into paths, in your opinion?
That's, yeah, like, this whole green witch, cottage core, sea witch stuff, like, it's something that seems to have, I've only been aware of it for the last 5 years. And I'm not super familiar with it. But, you know, sure, you're drawn to the sea. But, you know, consider that the sea birthed the land. And if you think about the way continental drift works, you know, the you have the subduction zone of the tectonic plate goes under the other tectonic plate, and then, you know, the other tectonic plate rises up above it, and that's how you get mountains. And that happens under the sea all the time as the tectonic plates are colliding, and, you know, so there's a continual process of new land being made and birthed from the sea. So if you're a sea witch, your ocean gave birth to the land. And if you're a forest witch or a land witch or whatever, then you still have to relate to the sea because the sea gave birth to the land. So either way, and, you know, think about rivers. Rivers carve out the land. So, you know, I'm very attached to land. Unfortunately, the land I'm very attached to is England. And I now live in Canada, but, you know, I'm learning how to relate to this land, which is also complicated by the fact that we stole it from Indigenous people. And that's a whole other bag of,
we're getting into that, the spirit of place conversation. And that is my thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's so important and it's so overlooked. Like, yeah. But again, it's a good example. Like, spirit of place is my favorite thing to really tap into. It makes my magic what it is. And it's more folksy now, my magic, because of that connection. But, you know, my coven that I'm still initiated in, still a part of, is a fairy tradition coven. But that doesn't mean it's not still part of it. You know, like, there's so many ways you can kind of scaffold on your path without abandoning something fully. You know, it's things come to the forefront, or things shift, or your perspectives change on certain things. Like,
I mean, I always say about, you know, okay, so in terms of like how I relate to the land, I relate to it as a totality. But then I also relate to specific places within the land. So, like, especially stone circles and burial mounds and specific, you know, there's a place near us in Ontario where there's these mounds that seem to have been made by some kind of glacial process. But they remind me of burial mounds. So I really relate to this place because it's so... it feels like my kind of place. And so you can always find something that you can relate to in a specific, you know, like I love the spring in Ontario when everything's brown because the snow is melted and everything's brown, and then suddenly the spring rain comes and, like, the grass just explodes out of the ground and it's all green and it's amazing. So, like, you can always find something to connect with where you are. But I think that when you're adding a new thing to your path, whether that's a spiritual practice from another form of paganism or witchcraft, or a spiritual practice from, say, Buddhism or Taoism or something, obviously, if it's from another tradition like Buddhism or Taoism, then please acknowledge the source that, you know, it came from that tradition, because otherwise we're into cultural appropriation land. But does the practice that you're borrowing or appropriating or whatever, does it actually fit with the goal of your practice? Because to me, the goal of pagan practice is, and, you know, other people may feel differently about this, but this is how I feel about it. In Christianity, you're pouring out yourself on the altar of the divine, and that process is known as kenosis. And then you wait like an empty vessel for the divine to fill you with new divine energy, and that process is called theosis. Paganism isn't that at all. Paganism is, I am divine already. Mm-hmm. And I already have the divine.
Yes.
What's happened to that inner core of divinity is that other things have got accreted onto it. So, like, encrusted on it. And so, like, you know, capitalism and gender roles and, you know, like other social expectations around you have to earn a living and you have to do this and you have to do that. And what we're doing in our spiritual process is removing the things that have been encrusted onto us by those societal processes and getting back to the true core of whatever it is you are. And that's how we become divine in paganism. So we have apotheosis, meaning becoming divine, becoming a god, as opposed to having divinity poured into us from the outside. We're realizing our divinity that was already there on the inside. And that's actually part of what my next book is going to be about. It's on the way.
That's exciting.
Yeah, so provisional title so far is Pagan Roots.
I like that.
Cool. That's in process. It's really important that we are not, you know, because I see too many pagans and witches, mostly witches, I think, on Instagram, saying things like, I'm doing my best to kill my ego. It's like, no, we don't kill the ego in paganism. Share its relationship to the rest of the psyche, but we're not about killing the ego. The ego is an important defense mechanism in your psyche. We need that. You know, like what you're doing is like connecting the ego to the other parts of the psyche, you know, the id and the superego, and getting it all working in harmony together. We're not killing the ego.
There's a chapter in I have one course online called Everyday Magical Living, and it kind of goes through every aspect of mindset shifts and then the practical side of things. And one of my chapters is actually called, I'm trying to remember the word I settled on because I went through so many, like placating the ego, containing the ego, befriending the ego. And I think I went with befriending the ego because there is this part of us that needs to overcome it, but we also aren't trying to beat it into submission. We're trying to just turn to it and say, hey, why are you getting so upset about, you know, this word or this line we're in, or that guy not smiling back at you at the concert or whatever it is. Like there's these things that flare us up, and that's the ego, and there's a reason for it. And sometimes it's false. Sometimes it's shadow work. Sometimes it's, you know, just one of those things you got to have a conversation with it and say, all right, let's work through this together.
I think a lot of the time that's projecting our inner archetypes onto people outside of us as well. Like, you know, like have a paranoid disposition, you know, like try not to sort of think, oh yeah, that person was thinking about me in a bad way. It's like, no, I'm thinking about myself in a bad way, and I'm seeing that reflected in that other person. The trick is fix your inner self-talk, you know.
And literally the chapter before that one is on reality is subjective, reality is personal. There's so many things that, you know, get projected onto us that we're like, what the hell? But then we don't always realize like we do that too. There's just that disconnect.
Yeah. I mean, like the reason that person A will dislike person B is because they're actually really similar, and person A is seeing their shadow in person B. I've just been watching Ultimatum Queer Love. Highly recommended. Because it's Netflix, there are issues, but it was really interesting. Like one of the people, Lexi, takes an intense dislike to Vanessa. And I'm like, that's a giant projection situation. You're projecting your control freakery onto her. obviously we're watching reality TV, so we're only seeing like what the producers of the show want us to see. So like, you know, all the Vanessa haters online, like wind your neck, because we don't know, you know, that's not Vanessa is a multifaceted human being, and you know, so is Lexi, and they're just, you know, they're 20 somethings working through their shit, so give them all a break. But you know, it's a really interesting show. Gets you thinking about what is marriage? Why are we doing marriage? What's that all about then? You know, it's really good.
Yeah. Oh, I haven't heard of that. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, it's great. So
so I have one last question for you, and we can end on this because I think it's a, I think you're gonna have a very empowering answer. What would you say to those witches out there who feel lost on their path?
Cool. I think that look at what is it that's making you feel lost? Why, you know, are you having a dry spell? Have you not found people that you can connect with? You know, find a group that fits your level of commitment and that's safe and doesn't put up a load of red flags for you. You know, find other people, whether preferably in person, but if, you know, if it's online, also good. You know, find your people, find your community, because having other people to practice with and bounce ideas off is really important. You know, that to me is a really important part of my spirituality, is doing my witchcraft with other people. You know, society wants to put us in boxes and fragment us and prevent us from forming real community with other people. You know, put your boots on and go and wade into some community, because that's, and not online, because, like, I mean, online is great as a substitute, but the real thing is connecting with real other people in person, in my opinion. You know, bear in mind that nothing's perfect. Like, you can find community that's good enough, and maybe you'll find your people. But like, go back to the roots of what it is that made you want to be a witch in the first place, and reconnect with that. Like, one of the reasons I'm really interested in folk witchcraft is because the thing that attracted me to witchcraft in the first place was the idea of folk witchcraft. And my practice of Wicca is very folky oriented. Like, there's very little Western mystery tradition in my Wicca at all. It's all based on witchcraft. It's all based on, like, the runes and Celtic stuff and folk witchcraft, and you know, there's no Kabbalah in my witchcraft. Not because, I mean, I like Kabbalah and it's great, but it's, to me personally, it's not part of witchcraft. Or it's not part of my witchcraft, I should say. Obviously, if you're a Jewish witch, then you know, maybe it is part of your witchcraft. But, like, the touchstone of all this is, what brings you joy? What makes you feel more connected to nature? What makes you feel alive and celebrating being alive? Because that's what paganism is all about to me. It's about celebrating being alive.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, find the sources of your joy and find your people. Like, when I was having my wobble, which was what gave rise to writing Changing Paths, somebody said to me that they'd noticed that paganism was what was, like, the wellspring of my joy, that always comes back to paganism. And what Unitarianism was doing for me was, it was healing a wound.
Yeah.
Because it was healing my wounds from Christianity. So that was an important part of my process. But, like, it wasn't the source of, you know, it was a joyful thing and it was great, but it wasn't the wellspring of my joy. And that was what made me go, okay, paganism's it. I'm going to be a pagan till the day I die. probably in my next life too.
Yeah.
You know, so just find the wellspring of your joy.
That's beautiful. That's great advice.
Thank you.
Merry meet.
Merry part.
And merry meet again. Thank you for joining us on the Magic Kitchen podcast. Please visit my website, leandrawitchwood.com, for news, information, and more episodes.
I'm Elise Wells, and I can be found at Seeking Numina on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook, and seekingnumina.com. That's Seeking, N-U-M-I-N-A.